Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Sound check. It's on your radio.
Sound check.
Listen to it with your ears.
Sound check.
On the internet.
Sound check.
Sound check.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Remember back at the beginning of the year, wasn't that long ago after all, we had Matthew Perpetua of BuzzFeed Music on to tell us what to look out for in music this year? Well, one thing Matthew said really struck me. Listen.
Basically, the rest of this decade is going to be the 50th anniversary of every single thing the Beatles ever did, and it all kind of happens now.
Well, and it's a bigger topic than we have time for now, but the Beatles going out of copyright is like a major story that we're going to see unfolding, I think.
Love, love me do. You know I love you. I'll always be true.
Now, not all of the Beatles stuff is going out of copyright, but in the European Union, this song did. And so did this one.
I love you.
That's right. Early songs by the Beatles are out of copyright and now in the public domain in Europe. So what does that mean? We'll get some answers from our copyright expert, the Copycat. Also, live music from the indie pop band Rah Rah Riot. But if Matthew Perpetua is right, we're going to spend the rest of this decade marking the 50th anniversary of everything the Beatles have ever done. And if the New York Times is right, we're going to spend the rest of this year reading books that just don't measure up to my first guest's latest effort. George Saunders is one of America's master storytellers. He was actually heading down a musical path himself at one point, but since 1996, he's become known for his short stories, their distinctive use of language, their odd blend of the horrific and the humorous. His new collection is called 10th of December, and the New York Times Magazine proclaimed on the cover that it is the best book you'll read this year. George Saunders, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me.
I was planning on reading War and Peace later this year.
No, actually, the plan is nobody will read anything else, and then we'll make that come true.
It's a remarkable collection of stories, and I want to start with something that you said in conversation with your editor, Andy Ward, in Slate. You said, realism is to fiction what gravity is to walking, a confinement that allows dancing under the right circumstances.
That's kind of nifty, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, very. How long did it take you to come up with that?
No, it's just, No, you know, I have this, my work is often discussed in terms of realism versus absurdism. And my experience of life has been that that's kind of a meaningless distinction.
Right.
You know, if you get into a weird enough place, realism isn't adequate to describe it. So I think when we're reading, there are certain kind of rules of engagement that almost any reading mind would respond to. So, for example, detail is a good one. Velocity is a good one. A moment that makes the reader lean in with a kind of, oh yeah, that's happened to me kind of feeling is a good one. We tend to call those things, we tend to associate those things with realism.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, it's just like gravity. Gravity isn't good or bad. It doesn't have a lot of opinions, but it just is. And whatever you're doing in the physical realm, you have to take it into account.
Yeah. So is that something that you need to be aware of as a storyteller, or is it simply just like gravity? You don't even think about it. It just is.
I think the former, because sometimes I think, certainly when I was a young writer, I thought I could work around those things or maybe that innovation meant ignoring them. But then you sort of find out that the form is what it is, the mind is what it is. So if you want, it's almost like the first required job is to get the reader paying attention.
Mm.
Then all the other stuff can happen. So in some ways, it's a very sort of traditional deal. You know,
Now, what about, do you look for the same sort of thing in songwriting, in some of the songs you've picked for us today?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, I picked them partly because I wasn't a big reader as a young person. Kind of maybe some genre stuff, but not a literary
You mean
person.
Like sci-fi and that sort
yeah,
of thing?
Yeah, or Ayn Rand, or even just a lot of books like you know, world's greatest fighter pilots, that kind of thing. Yeah. So I wasn't a big reader, but at that time in high school, I was getting a lot of aesthetic buzz from music, of course. So then only the last couple of years, I've realized how influential some of these early songs were in defining for me what a story could be or should be. So I was kind of a bright enough kid, but a little you know, lazy. But these in Chicago in the 70s, FM radio was really vibrant. So you'd hear kind of a mainstream rock piece, and then something by Segovia, Leo Kottke, and then, you know, so it was a great way to kind of get your cultural awareness boosted up just by sitting there listening.
Wow. Yeah. And you, I mean, the New York Times article where they say that, you know, 10th of December is the best book you'll read this year.
Say it again.
They have this picture of you with the Fender Telecaster, the electric guitar, the Johnny Winter hair. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you said something to the effect that, you know, we all, during the course of our lives, we have different, you know, we're all different people at different times. Who were you back then? Tell us about the George Saunders, who was the wannabe jazz fusion guitarist.
I was a kid who I was not going to go to college, had no interest in it, and there's a guy in my high school who was a fantastic guitar player, and he said we're going to have a band, and he said he actually knew somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody in the Eagles, and so the thing was came.
So you were set.
I was all set. Why did I have to go to college? But he said something like, you know, I've gotten in with these guys. We'll be the opening act for the opening act. And now that's funny, except that I do remember going into a music store with him and buying a PA, and he had a check for $10,000 from somebody. So I really don't know what was going on there. But I read Atlas Shrugged, actually, and that made me think about college. I don't know how I had this romantic image of myself strolling through a campus in what I thought of as a college sweater, you know. So I quit the band. But at that point, I was doing a lot of, you know, my parents were great, and they let me set up my stuff in the front room. So I'd put on Ted Nugent and jam along, or the Allman Brothers, and, you know. So that. Yeah.
Well, now you mentioned Chicago, which is, I guess, where you grew up.
Yes.
The first song that you've picked for us comes from Steve Goodman.
Right.
Well-known Chicago Cubs fan, the guy who wrote the song Dying Cubs Fan's Last Request. I mean, he's most famous for having written City of New Orleans,
right.
which was a big hit for Arlo Guthrie. Strangely, though, you have picked a song that Steve Goodman did not write.
That's right. It was written by a guy named Mike Smith. And one of the kind of interesting stories is that many, many years later, when I was really struggling to write my first book, I was getting kind of desperate, you know. And this guy, Mike Smith, did a songwriting seminar in Rochester in some guy's living room. Like, he paid $50 and he was a brilliant talker about writing. And he said something that really changed my whole trajectory. He said, what you do is you write a song, then play it on your recording, then listen to your hero. And he said, for example, Dylan. And everybody groaned. He said, no. He said, if you have the impulse that your work sucks, that is so great because it means you still have taste. Yeah, and then he said, and that feeling of revulsion or disappointment that you have is what will lead you, because all you have to do is look honestly at it and say, okay, how is it falling short? Mm-hmm. And somehow that got in my head, and it was a very hopeful kind of a thing. So, but anyway, Steve Goodman, I grew up in the South Suburbs, and my dream as a kid was to go to Old Town, hang out at one of those clubs, and then have Steve Goodman instantly, just by looking at me, recognize me for the guitar virtuoso I was, and then say, "Hey, kid, I need a," you know. So that never happened, but I just love the song. So.
All right, the author George Saunders is with us. His new collection is called 10th of December, and he's made up a little playlist for us, beginning with "The Dutchman" from Steve Goodman.
The Dutchman's not the kind of man who keeps his thumb jammed in the dam that holds his dreams in. That's a secret only Margaret knows. When Amsterdam is golden in the summer, Margaret brings him breakfast she believes in. He thinks tulips bloom beneath the snow. He's mad as he could be. Margaret only sees that sometimes. Sometimes she sees her unborn children in his eyes. Let us go to the banks of the ocean, where the walls rise above the Zuiderzee. long ago. I used to be a young man. Dear Margaret, remember.
Just a little bit of The Dutchman from Steve Goodman, a song written by Mike Smith and popularized by the late Steve Goodman. And the author George Saunders, his latest book is 10th of December. He's here with us in the Soundcheck studio sharing a playlist with us on the program today. Let me ask you about 10th of December. You're an unrepentant music fan.
I am.
Do you consider 10th of December in a way to be a concept album?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, as somebody who grew up in the 70s, I used to take so much pleasure in, you know, laying out the album art and kind of analyzing why the songs were in the order they are. And actually, on this one, I tend to work by having a pretty good idea of what's going in at some point, then laying them all out. And then the trick is to try to figure out the order so that the collection kind of tells an Uber story, you know, in addition to the... So I got a little lost. And my daughter actually said to me, Dad, just think of it like an album. And I said, what do you mean? She goes, well, I don't know, put the good one, the best one first and last, and make sure that nothing, there's not too long of a stretch of suckiness in the middle, you know. So, and that was right, you know. So I think that's kind of part of your job is to, you're doing the individual stories, and then in the ordering, you can kind of tell a very subtle secondary story.
Now, people who read The New Yorker will already be familiar with some of the stories, and the Spiderhead story, the one about the sort of futurist dystopian pharmaceutical experiment.
Yeah.
There is a kind of an echo of that much later in the book,
right,
in the story My Chivalric Fiasco.
Right.
So was that sort of intended, or are you supposed to sort of think back to the earlier story?
Yes, hopefully. But also, since no one will, you know, this isn't radio and I can just say it.
It is radio,
no,
in fact.
Oh,
George.
Well, I'll say it anyway. That story actually...
What did you think this was?
I thought it was just hanging out. What the hell? I was wondering why the headphones are on. No, but that story actually dropped out of The Spider. I had that in there as a riff where, you know, the idea that a drug could change the diction of the speaker.
Right.
But it didn't fit in that one, but I kind of like this. So sometimes I'll just let something fall off and say, okay, go make your own room now.
So it's an outtake.
It's an outtake. It's a revamped outtake.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. So do you have a lot of that sort of thing lying around the office?
Not at the moment, but usually, yeah. Yeah, I think it's, you know, I have the sense that a story exists pretty platonically perfect in your mind. But sometimes in telling it, you drop it and it shatters. So part of the rewriting process is to try to recobble that original version. And in the process, your mind will sometimes actually weirdly crossfire and give you something from another story. So my sense is if I'm writing something and it doesn't go in, if it's got good energy, I just set it aside and say, I'm sorry I got you in the wrong story. Stay there and I'll try to use you later.
Well, now, you know, in music, the completest fan always wants to hear the musician's outtakes.
Right,
you know,
right.
We want to hear those alternate versions, the original demos. We want to hear all of that kind of stuff.
Sure.
Would you ever like share these, you know, these sort of set aside things if they don't actually find their own?
You know, I had a period a few years ago where I did, and then something about it didn't feel quite right. I think, you know, in some ways, at the highest level as an artist, you're responsible for the best version, the tightest version, and so if you do something good and it doesn't get in, that's okay. As Faulkner said, cut your darlings and, you know, let them go.
And as your daughter said, try not to have too much suckiness in the middle.
That's a mantra for all of us artists. Don't suck.
We're speaking with George Saunders, the author. His latest release is 10th of December, a collection of his short stories. And you brought in, you know, you played for us this Steve Goodman song. The next song that you picked is a guy who was long associated with Steve Goodman.
Yeah, I hoped that him and Steve would be together at this thing when they recognize me.
This is John Prine
that
we're
right.
talking about.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you had this kind of jazz fusion thing happening in the 70s, but the singer-songwriter thing was certainly lurking somewhere as well.
Yeah, actually, in the 70s, it was more that. And when I got to college, I got into a sort of like a Return to Forever type clone band. Yeah, but I this song, I always loved it because it's so sort of frankly political and it doesn't make any apologies and it's funny. And, of course, it was the early 70s. So I remember the song Chicago by Graham Nash or some stuff by Kansas that was just kind of overtly political. Oh, the other thing that was always powerful for me was on the first Chicago album, there's an outtake, a kind of a recorded outtake from the convention riot. And my friend and I, who is equally political, used to listen to it over and over. And it was kind of like the music is building, and you hear these two guys who sound like Cheech and Chong, kind of. And the one guy goes, "Let's get out of here, man." And then suddenly you hear the police are upon them. So there's something, growing up outside of Chicago, knowing that all the stuff was going on just a few miles away, was very kind of politicizing. So this song, the first time I heard it, I just thought it was great.
It's John Prine from 1971, and the song is "Your Flag Decal Won't Get You Into Heaven Anymore."
While digesting Reader's Digest in the back of the dirty bookstore, a plastic flag with gum on the back fell out on the floor. Well, I picked it up and I ran outside, slapped it on my window shield. And if I could see old Betsy Ross, I'd tell her how good I feel. But your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore. They're already overcrowded from your dirty little war. Now Jesus don't like killing, no matter what the reason's for. And your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore.
A little bit from John Prine from 1971, his song "Your Flag Decal Won't Get You Into Heaven Anymore."
Still relevant.
That idea that your art and your political engagement, that you as a person, as an artist, you're still the person who is, you know, either politically engaged or not.
Right.
And that is also a part of who you
exactly
are and what you
yeah
do.
You know, I always think there's a Chekhov story called Grief, and for me that's a real touchstone, because often people say, well, does politics belong in writing and so on? And that story is, there's no overt politics, but it's just a man whose son has died that day, but he's sort of a cab driver with, you know, horse-drawn carriages. And all day long, all he wants is for someone to listen to him, and nobody will. He's a nobody. And at the very end of the story, he steps into the stable and he just puts his head against the horse's snout and says, "I had a son. He's dead now." You know. So yeah. Is that a political story? Well, yeah, kind of, you know, given what will happen in Russia in 10 or 15 years.
Right.
But also it's all kept within the personal and the real.
And some of your stories. I mean, there's one tale in 10th of December of, you know, a guy who comes back from war. There was a guy in the gym today who came in full army fatigues, and I almost said, "Thanks for your service," which becomes this kind of catchphrase that everybody's saying to this guy after he comes in the story, after he comes back from war. And everyone's saying it, and no one's really meaning it. Mm-hmm. There's nothing political anywhere in that story.
Right, right.
But it is a political act,
right.
The act,
you know,
of writing that.
Right. I think if you imagine that a person in his or her wholeness and mental health is absolutely subject to outside forces. So, you know, if suddenly a person is unemployed and destitute, their grace is going to suffer. And so, therefore, the personal and the political are... You know, I did a piece for GQ a couple years ago where I lived in a homeless camp for 2 weeks, or 1 week, incognito. Seemed like 9 weeks. But that was a really great reminder of just this thing, because the politics of that situation are incredibly complicated and dark, you know, sort of the underbelly of America. All manifesting in personal stuff, like a young woman who literally had been hit by a train. She had a gangrenous foot, and she's a crackhead, and she's living in a tent, you know. So personal, political, what's the difference?
Yeah. We're speaking with the author George Saunders. His latest collection is called 10th of December, and George is sharing a playlist with us on Soundcheck today. A little bit later on in the show, we'll have live music from the band Ra Ra Riot. Their new album is called Beta Love, and it's got this kind of futurist theme to it. You know, William Gibson, the cyberpunks, Ray Kurzweil, the futurist writer. You have a little, you know, there's certainly a kind of futurist element that has been in a lot of your stories.
Sure.
And for you, Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut, that was another touchstone.
It was, yeah. And it was one that I came to early and didn't get. I'd heard that it was set in World War II, and he'd been there. And I was a big Hemingway guy. So the first time I read it, I thought, "God, Kurt, you wasted it. You know, there's spaceships in this." And then many years later, when I tried writing myself, and also when I kind of been knocked around a bit by life, I came back to it. And then it seemed to me like this masterpiece of understatement and minimalism that was, for me then, you know, much more powerful than anything I ever read about war.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the understatement of Kurt Vonnegut. I was looking for a word earlier today to try and capture the tone that seems to run through all of the stories in 10th of December, and the one I hit on was understated. And a lot of the music that you've picked for us has a certain understated quality as well, although perhaps not this next song.
Probably not.
Tell us about, I'll hazard a guess here, the Dejurik sisters.
Dejurik sisters, yeah. They're, all I know about them is they were, I think, from the 30s, somewhere out west, and they had this extraordinary talent, which we'll hear. But I use this, I teach at Syracuse, and I use this in a little mini class on escalation, which to me is one of the prime skills in storytelling. You have to get the water to boil. And so when we talk about this song, we play it five or six times, and we talk about the way that an element gets introduced and then is absolutely not allowed to sit there statically. I'll give it away. If a yodel comes in, just say, then the yodeling is going to escalate. And since they bring to the table this idea of weird sounds, the weird sounds are going to escalate. So nothing is allowed to sort of flatline. Everything has to be constantly headed upwards.
This is called The Arizona Yodeler from 1938 and the Dejurik Sisters.
How I know now where the folks you meet all know a thing or two. Live the land of great ambition, who had set as his life's mission to excel upon his own day. And he played a little tune on his Spanish guitar. He'd mingle with a song, the sweet refrain. He would get a lot of practice on his yodel. As his cattle he was trailing, you would always hear him wailing on his yodel. Once a big shot from the city heard him warbling the ditty, and a company was oddity. Then he said, "Look here, my sonny, you can make a lot of money with the oddity."
And it gets crazier.
Holy cow!
Yeah. And that's—I guess that's what they did. They just yodeled. That's...
George Saunders picking the hits for us on Soundcheck today. His latest release is a collection of his short stories called 10th of December. He's sharing his playlist with us, which includes that 1938 Arizona Yodeler from the Dejurik Sisters. Man, that's what do your students at Syracuse make of that?
Well, I've played it the first time, and the looks were just shocked, you know. And then as we, you know, and it's really interesting to watch them because I almost any human being listening to that song will get a little giddy at the end because it just keeps going. And you say, what are they doing? So I mean, to me, that, you know, part of storytelling, that maybe in teaching in the academic setting, it's easy to lose sight of this, that you're really trying to delight somebody. You're trying to kick somebody's butt and kind of surprise them. So if you keep that as the main goal, the Dejurik Sisters are kind of a nice role models.
And it just occurs to me, mentioning Syracuse University, our musical guest, Ra Ra Riot, all from Syracuse.
Really?
All from Syracuse University. It's where they met. I'm sure that will come up in our conversation. George, do you listen to music while you write?
No, never, never. I it's for the same reasons I don't drink while I write. I think you're trying to make an intimate connection with this person that you don't know. So I think for me, a flat aspect, you know, as the writer is best. So your perceptions aren't being altered in any way. And when I was younger and I listened to music, you know, you could type up the phone book, and if you're listening to the Pogues, it's very moving, you know. But unfortunately, you can't count on the fact that the reader's listening to the Pogues. So I don't. Sometimes what I will do, though, is, you know, I find that to write, it helps me to be just a little happy, just a little happy. So if I'm not feeling it, I'll drive into town on an errand and put something in. And lately, the Wilco, that beautiful song, One Sunday Morning, it's just an epic. And I listen to that, and I'm ready to go, you know. But then it has to go off before I start typing.
This is how I tell it. Oh, but it's long. One Sunday morning. Oh, one sun is gone.
Was speaking with George Saunders. His new album.
Yes, I've been waiting to hear that all my life.
Well, we did talk about how 10th of December, your new collection of stories, is like a concept album. So, yeah, there you go. Yeah. You're welcome.
Sure.
His
you.
New
Thank
album
you.
Is called 10th of December. The New York Times says it's already the best book you'll read this year. I have certainly enjoyed reading it, and George has been sharing his playlist with us on the program of mostly older material. What have you been listening to recently?
Well, I have two daughters who are, you know, big music fans, so they kind of keep me a little bit. So this next one is Middle Brother, who I'd never heard of before, and great song. But, you know, Wilco, Elliot Smith is somebody who I just go deeper and deeper with him. Also, you know who I really love is John Adams, the composer, and his piece on the Transmigration of Souls, which I've only listened to three times because I'm reduced to a puddle of weeping every time.
That's the work that he wrote for the New York Philharmonic for the first anniversary of the 9/11 attacks.
Right, right. Yeah. Really moving. And, you know, I think, I don't know, I tend to listen to music almost to sort of press a button that I know exists. So if I go to listen to, say, the Allman Brothers or whoever it is, I kind of know what I want. But with Adams, I love coming to his pieces fresh without any preconceptions, and then he always manages to move me and kind of wake me up a little bit.
Yeah, he's an extraordinary composer, Pulitzer Prize winner. But Middle Brother, this is something you got from one of your daughters?
Yeah, she sent me a little CD, and this song, again, this is, I think, such a beautiful piece of writing because kind of a simple idea gets introduced, and then pop, 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 three little manifestations.
That escalation you were talking
about?
Yeah,
very simple, very original. And also the way that some of the lines come out are so clever and sweet.
Yeah, we'll hear a little bit from this band called Middle Brother. We've been speaking with the author, George Saunders. His new book is a collection called 10th of December. George, this has been a lot of fun. Thank
I
you
really
for coming
enjoyed it.
In.
Thanks for having me.
This is Soundcheck.
Ooh. When it hits me that she's left me alone. When I finally move on. My life, her goodbye written into stone, and her shadow grown into a night.
Up next, the Copycat returns with a look at the legal strategy behind a new Bob Dylan release that is actually called the Copyright Extension Collection Volume 1. And later... You heard me telling George Saunders about this indie pop band, Ra Ra Riot. They're about to release a new album called Beta Love. And we'll hear Ra Ra Riot playing songs from it coming up later on Soundcheck. They say there are 8 million stories in the Naked City. This is one of them. Sure, it's a crime story, but this one's kind of complicated. Intellectual property. That's right, baby. Copyright. Trademarks. What happens when the public domain gets a little too public? To explain it, you need someone who knows the law. To some, he's a mild-mannered attorney. But to us, he's the Copycat. Yes, it's in troubling times like these that we turn to the Copycat, otherwise known as intellectual property attorney Jonathan Reichman from the firm Kenyon & Kenyon LLP. John, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thank you, John.
We knew this was a job for the Copycat when we saw the subtitle of this Bob Dylan release, the 50th anniversary collection, The Copyright Extension Collection Volume 1. Sony released like literally just 100 copies, rushed to a handful of European stores just before the end of last year. Why would they do that?
Okay, this is the story. The record industry, as we know, is very beleaguered by everything going on online, so they've been looking for lots of ways to increase their revenues and increase their rights. And here they were faced with a situation where copyrights and numerous sound recordings had a 50-year term of protection.
In Europe. So,
in Europe, right. Mm-hmm. We're only talking about the European Union countries. So they were faced with the expiration of the copyright in a lot of really super famous recordings. And they wanted to be able to keep these sound recordings under copyright protection. Mm-hmm. So they lobbied the European Parliament for a 20-year extension of the copyright term in these sound recordings. And the Parliament agreed to that extension, but they put some qualifications on it. And the most significant one was that if at the end of this 50-year term the recording was not in circulation, in other words, you couldn't buy it, you couldn't a CD of it, you couldn't download it, then potentially the protection could be lost.
So it's a use it or lose it thing.
Exactly. So what a lot of the record companies are doing, they're feverishly looking at what they have in their libraries that hadn't been released, and they're getting it out on the market so that when the 50-year term hits with respect to a particular recording, they can say, hey, it's still in circulation, it's still out there, therefore we're entitled to this 20-year extension term.
So these Bob Dylan recordings, which are mostly like outtakes and, mm-hmm. and alternate studio versions, these are things that by releasing it before January 1st of this year, mm-hmm. They now can say, hey, these are out there, they've been published, we now get to keep them for 70 years instead of 50.
Exactly. If it's in use and in circulation at the 50-year point, it gets this extra 20-year term. But if not, if you go backward, anything older than that is in the public domain.
So we see the bizarre sight of the Beatles' first single, Love Me Do, being now in the public domain over in Europe, but of course not here, where copyright laws are different and longer. And these Bob Dylan songs that are on this copyright extension collection, is almost like a joke that that's the subtitle of the record.
I know.
These are recordings that would have been in the public domain, out of copyright, if Sony hadn't released them before January 1st. And here's one of them. This is the Ballad of Hollis Brown by a young Bob Dylan.
Hollis Brown, he lived on the outside of town. Hollis Brown, he lived on the outside of town. With his wife and five children and his cabin falling down. You looked for work and money and you walked a ragged mile. You looked for work and money and you walked a ragged mile. Your children are so hungry that they don't know how to smile. There's bed bugs on your baby's bed, there's chinches on your wife. There's bed bugs on your baby's bed, there's chinches on your wife. Gangrene snuck in your side, it's a cutting you like a knife.
That's a little bit of Bob Dylan recorded in either 62 or 63. The important date, though, is that it was released by Sony before January 1st of this year. The Ballad of Hollis Brown is part of the 50th anniversary collection subtitled The Copyright Extension Collection, Volume 1. The law in Europe says anything released after January 1st of 1963 is now protected by copyright for an additional 20 years. It used to be a 50-year copyright, and now the copyright extension gives Sony a 70-year copyright on all of these Bob Dylan songs. We found that one, by the way, on YouTube. We're speaking with the Copycat. Our copyright expert is intellectual property attorney Jonathan Reichman from Kenyon & Kenyon LLP. Now, if Sony hadn't gotten these songs out by January 1st, what would have happened to them?
Well, the procedure is a little complicated. The way it technically works is that the sound recording itself is put into the public domain. The performer recaptures the performance rights, which means that other companies can now release that recording because it's in the public domain.
As long as they pay a fee to the artist.
To the artist and to the composer. And this is another very important misunderstanding to clear up, is that this new law has absolutely no bearing on the copyright and the underlying music and lyrics. That's a separate copyright. That's governed by a term of life of the author plus 70 years, and that was always the case.
Right. We're talking about the actual recording made in Apple Studios, wherever it was, if you're the Beatles, or wherever it was.
Exactly.
So who benefits from this 20-year extension mostly?
Well, there's a lot of controversy. You know, the record companies said that they were really doing this for the benefit of all the studio musicians because there are other terms in this new law that say in return for this 20-year term, the record companies have to set aside 20% of the royalties for the studio musicians and the performers, even though they were paid at the outset 50 years or 60 or 70 years earlier. So there are some benefits for the musicians themselves, but I think the big beneficiaries of this are the record companies themselves, because now they get tacked on an additional 20-year term of protection.
As long as the things were in circulation by January 1st of this year. Which is why these Bob Dylan songs have suddenly appeared in just a handful of European record stores. And again, we're talking specifically about European copyright, the European Union. Music published in 1962 is now in the public domain in the European Union, and that includes the Beatles' first single, Love Me Do, released in October of 1962, and its B-side, P.S. I Love You. Jonathan Reichman is the copycat, the intellectual property attorney from the firm Kenyon & Kenyon LLP. Jonathan, great to speak with you again.
Same here. Thanks, John.
This is Soundcheck.
So please, love me do. Whoa, love me do.
Join us tomorrow on Soundcheck for a look at one of the hottest up-and-coming music scenes in the country, Nashville. A city known for mainstream country music is sounding a little different these days. That's tomorrow on Soundcheck. Up next, a live performance in our studio from the indie pop band Ra Ra Riot. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The band Ra Ra Riot has gone through quite a bit of change over the course of its 6 years, changing labels, changing lineup, changing the place they call home. But the band's upcoming album called Beta Love may mark its biggest shift yet towards this more synth-heavy sound. We'll hear more about everything that's happened since the band was last here in our studio, but first, let's hear a song. Here's Ra Ra Riot with the title track from the album Beta Love, live on Soundcheck.
Golden light, don't know why. If I run to you, would you stay? I might be a prototype, but we're both real inside. Beep.
less hope. I believe you can't tell me no, it's no dream. In this city of robot hearts, ours were made to be. You'll take me up this time. You'll take me up this time. I was made for that place, no way to deny. We'll find my beetle. Would I find my beetle? You will be my beetle. My beetle. Now we're getting closer.
The band is Ra Ra Riot, live in the Soundcheck studio with the title track from their forthcoming album Beta Love, which comes out on January 22nd. And nice to have the members of the band back here in our studio. Wes Miles, hey. Singing. Rebecca Zeller playing a very, very sparkly violin.
Yeah.
Is that a real violin or is it an electric?
No, it's a real acoustic violin, but I have like this Fishman Bridge pickup on it.
Mm-hmm. And glitter all over
yeah,
it.
Yeah, and gold glitter cover.
And bass player Matt Santos is back with us. Milo Bonacci playing the guitar and some keyboards. And sort of pressed into service today, Clarice Jensen on loan from the band Y Music, playing cello, Kenny Bernard behind our drum kit. So it's a little bit of a different lineup, Rebecca, from the last time you guys were here.
Yeah, yeah.
Alexandra Lawn, your longtime cellist,
yes.
has left the band. Mm-hmm. Has that caused some kind of rejiggering of roles within the group?
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, for me, I'm singing now.
Mm-hmm.
I had to fill some space, but
and
yeah.
some keyboards too.
And
you're playing.
Some keyboards, yeah. Have a lot of new responsibilities with this new record, but it's nice to have a challenge.
Yeah.
But yeah, we've all been sort of, I think, partially, you know, because of her departure, but also an intentional choice.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of mixing things up a bit and people. You know, like Matt's playing guitar, Milo's doing both keys, you know, and guitar. So everyone's sort of jack of all trades, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. And it shows up in a kind of a different sound to the band. I mean, for the first couple of records, Ra Ra Riot, Wes, you were the guys who had the violin and the cello. You had
yeah.
the string
yeah.
section, you know,
yeah.
sort of a defining sound.
Yeah.
This new album's going to be a lot more kind of high-tech sounding.
Yeah.
And that title track, Beta Love, I mean, it's full of, like, imagery from the William Gibson cyberpunk
yeah.
novels
yeah.
and stuff like that. So they seem to go well together. Which idea came first, the sound or those images?
Well, I guess I started reading stuff like that, and a few of us started reading stuff like, you know, Ray Kurzweil and Gibson around the end of the Orchard cycle. So our previous record, when we were sort of wrapping up,
mm-hmm.
I guess actually in the middle of it, really. So those ideas have been around.
Now, Ray Kurzweil, I mean, yeah. this is a guy who's known as a futurist, but isn't he also the inventor of the Kurzweil synthesizer?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So a guy with yeah. very strong musical
yeah.
Connection, too.
Yeah, so we as a band, were sort of getting into that, but particularly Matt was getting into Kurzweil's writing, and I was getting really into Gibson's writing.
Mm-hmm. Now, are any of the... There are numerous synthesizers here. Are
no,
any
we don't have
Kurzweil's?
A Kurzweil synthesizer. But yet, I should say.
Yeah.
Are they hard to get, or...?
That's Milo's way of expertise. Are they?
No harder than any
other. Yeah. Milo says no harder than any other. We're speaking with the members of the band Ra Ra Riot, some of whom are on mic and some of whom are not. Their album Beta Love comes out on January 22nd, and they will be playing that night at the Music Hall of Williamsburg in Brooklyn. And then there's a sold-out show later that week, Friday the 25th, at Webster Hall. They're playing for us here in the studio today. Now, you guys recorded this in a pretty well-known studio, but you had to travel to get there, right,
yeah.
Rebecca?
Yeah. We recorded at Sweet Tea, which was in Oxford, Mississippi, with Dennis Herring, and it's his studio. When we had decided to work with Dennis, I actually hadn't heard of Sweet Tea.
Uh-huh. But a lot of, like, some pretty well-known people have gone there and worked with him at that studio.
Yeah, his, I mean, obviously Elvis Costello was one of the big ones that comes to mind. The Modest Mouse record.
The one with Float On?
Yeah, the one with Float On was recorded there. The Hives.
Oh,
yeah.
Right, the Hives. Waves.
Waves.
So it's so what drew Ra Ra Riot to go to Oxford, Mississippi to record there?
Dennis.
Okay. the chance to work. So that's how it is. You know, you find a producer that you're sort of intrigued by. What were you hoping to get from working with him?
I guess we sort of did have specific goals. I think one of the things is we wanted to be pushed a lot, and he was known for that, and he was very successful at doing that. And I think we just wanted a change. You know, at The Orchard, we produced it ourselves, and obviously The Rum Line, Ryan Hadlock produced, but we didn't want to keep doing the same thing. We wanted a different place for, you know, like, inspiration and, I don't know, shake things up a little bit.
Is place an important inspiration when you're closeted in a studio? I mean, isn't one place very much like another when you...
No, not really. And interestingly enough, this was the first album we did in a warm climate. Mm. And it really does matter, because when you leave the studio and you get to take, like, a breather, like, you want to clear your head, you're not, like, putting on your jackets and bundling up and just walking outside in the freezing cold. You know, like, the boys would be shooting hoops in, you know, the driveway, and I'd go on bike rides. And it's really actually affects, like, your mood, and then obviously that affects the way the album comes out.
Mm. So the album is called Beta Love, from the band Ra Ra Riot. And Wes, talking about place, you all came from a place, from Syracuse, uh-huh. University of Syracuse.
Yeah.
And you guys went back there, kind of like a multi-day residency, right?
Yes.
Now, was that wasn't to, like, be the band playing every day. You went to, talk to the kids, right?
Yeah, it was, and we were supposedly teaching them. and it was a lot of fun. We were there for, like, about a week, maybe, like, 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
And we each had a class that we spoke to, or a few classes.
About what?
Well, they're all different things. Matt and I did a songwriting class, which was a lot of fun.
Clarice and I did a class for the orchestra, which was what to do with your classical music skills within a contemporary music world. That was really fun. Josh, our manager, and I spoke, because, you know, Syracuse has a really... you know, good music business program, which we went through.
Oh,
you know?
Okay.
So we went back and sort of spoke to our old class and focused on touring. And Milo spoke to a guitar class and a recording class. Kenny taught a drum class. So we all sort of, like, took what skills, you know, we excel at and hopefully taught them something. But
and did you finally give them a concert?
We did yeah.
All right.
Which was cool to play at Centner Auditorium there. It's, like, where I had all my classical, you know, orchestral and, you know, quartet concerts and all of that.
All right. The members of Ra Ra Riot, are you still Orangemen at heart? You know, you still follow the basketball
orange.
Team, bleeding orange?
I suppose we do on some level.
Yeah. it hits you at funny times. I think going back up there, you do feel like a sense of pride that, you know, this is where we all, you know, started together.
It's where it all got started for the band Rah Rah Riot, here with us in the Soundcheck studio. When I Dream, this was released before the rest of the record, wasn't it? So I'll call it the single. You want to play it for us?
Sure, yeah.
All right, the band Rah Rah Riot performing here in the Soundcheck studio. The album Beta Love is out on January 22nd. This song is called When I Dream. When I Dream is the name of that song from the band Rah Rah Riot, performing live in the Soundcheck studio. So, just briefly, again, Beta Love is the name of the record. Is this a concept album? I mean, are some of those William Gibson, Ray Kurzweil, futurist things running through all the songs?
I would say it's not, but there's obviously very clear, strong concepts in the record. So I think...
Wait a minute. Okay, so the answer is...
The difference to me is...
Yes and no.
Yeah, the difference to me is that we didn't set out to make a concept record.
Uh-huh.
But looking back on it, it's sort of like, well, this has, you know, very clear inspiration. So I guess I'm fine either way. Personally, I think of it as not a concept record.
I think there are some songs on the album that aren't... Don't fit exactly into that.
Yeah.
But the majority.
Yeah.
Well, but I mean, you know, if you have favorite concept albums, you can usually find a song or two.
Yeah.
I mean, even, you know, Ziggy Stardust or Dark Side of the Moon. You know, you can find songs that
don't
that are just there because
exactly,
they're songs.
Yeah.
I mean, do you guys listen to those old records? Do you have favorite concept albums?
I don't off the top of my head.
Sergeant
Pepper. Oh,
Sergeant.
Matt just said
Sgt.
Pepper.
Favorite concept record, actually.
That's Matt's favorite concept record.
One that maybe given your subject matter, you might check out Alan Parsons' iRobot, the Alan Parsons Project.
Okay.
He was the guy who produced Dark Side of the Moon.
Right,
oh,
okay.
Cool.
I mean, kind of similar sort of place that it's coming from, different sound, of course. We've been speaking with the members of the band Ra Ra Riot. They've been performing for us here in the studio today. Album comes out on January 22nd. That night, that Tuesday night, they're performing in Brooklyn at the Music Hall of Williamsburg, and then a sold-out show on Friday the 25th at Webster Hall. And I think this has become like a regular occurrence. Every time you guys release a record, you come here on the show. It's great to see you again. Congratulations
Thanks,
on the new disc.
Thank
very nice to be here.
This is Soundcheck.
Even though I was alone when I gave it up, despite all the weight you feel, I don't want you to reveal, though, as long as I feel I can tell the danger did it. Oh,
join us online tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern on soundcheck.org. We'll be doing a live audio stream with the folk rock singer and songwriter Erin McKeown. She'll join us to play songs from her new politically charged album, called Manifestra. Then on the air at 9, as the headquarters for mainstream country music, Nashville has long been known as Music City. But the scene there today is heating up with a much different sound. We'll hear some of the up-and-coming artists based in Nashville. Plus, members of the trio called the Lone Bellow hail from Georgia and Virginia. Now they're making Americana and country music in Brooklyn. They'll join us to play live. That does it for today's show. See you back here at 9 tomorrow. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.